Hello and welcome to Radio SGN. I am one of your humble hosts, A.V. Eichenbaum. Pronouns they, them, and with me, Isabel Mata, filling in for Lindsay while Lindsay's off in Spokane doing birthday stuff.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Isabel. Pronouns are she, her. I am so excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Isabel, of course, is the host of the Being Yourself Loudly podcast, which is also on the Seattle Gay News Podcasting Network. I'm glad that we could get you in here, get you recording. How are you? What's new?
I'm doing good. The weather is making me feel a gazillion times better. For those not in Seattle, it is sunny and 75. I can't believe it. It's like instant serotonin.
Yeah, the world is warming up. Crazy.
I know, right? That's what happens.
I mean, part of me is like, wow, I'm so glad to be finally getting that vitamin D. I'm operating most of the year here in Seattle on a lot less vitamin D than I was back home. And then part of me is like, oh, climate change, you know?
I know. It's fine. We're just going to enjoy it. Soak in the sun and try not to think about the impending doom of our country and the world.
Positive nihilism. That's what we got here.
I know.
Radio SGN. Well, we've got a great show coming up. I've got Isabel Sandoval. We're going to be talking about Translations Film Festival a little bit as our guest. But real quick, I want to just dive into some of our local coverage of the District 3 race. Of course, a lot of longtime listeners and regular listeners will know that we've had three of the candidates already on the show. We had Rye Armstrong, Andrew Ashiofu, and Joy Hollingsworth on the show to talk about their campaigns. And readers of the paper will know that Andrew Ashiofu has written an open letter about his campaign. We can expect, hopefully, more of that to come from other candidates. But the list has expanded.
It's like 10 people.
It is 10 people. It was 5 people. 4 of them were part of the LGBTQ community. Now it's 10 people and 5 of them are part of the LGBTQ plus community. So let's just get the rundown. We'll start with the queer candidates because that's what we're here for. We have Shobhit Agarwal. He lives on Capitol Hill with his husband, who is a movie reviewer. And according to his website, Agarwal's platform will focus on expanding green infrastructure, electrical vehicles and public transit, making housing affordable, expanding small businesses, and engaging minorities in policing. Mm. Also supporting minorities in women's rights, which we hear from a couple of other candidates in this vein.
What does it mean to engage minorities in policing?
Well, a lot of the folks in the SPD are white, just first and foremost, you know, and we see that just kind of looking at a lot of Seattle is white, but it is a more diverse place than, say, Everett or like Kirkland or the surrounding areas in the Pacific Northwest. And also because Seattle is one of the places that pays its police force a lot higher than other cities in the nation, we get a lot of people that come in from out of state who maybe haven't engaged with a lot of the diversity that we do experience here, haven't seen a trans person or like known a bisexual or met someone from Pakistan because they're from rural Kansas or something or Arizona. You know, it's a different vibe out there. And so I have my own opinions about the police force that we've gone over ad nauseum at this point, but I do think that engaging minorities, especially engaging local people in the police force, if we're going to move in that direction, is a better step than just bringing in basically people who don't know the community and aren't part of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd rather see, you know, engaging minorities in teaching. You know, I think it would be a lot more impactful to have a lot more minorities in those roles, starting with kids from a young age. But, you know, we'll take what she can get. The next candidate is Andrew.
Andrew Ashiofu. Yeah, he's been on the show. Super nice guy. You can go and listen to that interview. We talked a lot about his stuff. He was houseless for a while in Chicago.
I love his platform, personally.
Yeah, I think he has a lot to say. I think he's got a pretty solid ideal to look at things. I mean, I will say from our interview, I think some of his priorities are not my priorities, but that's what diversity in politics are. He would be the first openly HIV positive member. You and Lindsay talked about this gentleman when I was out of town. So you have opinions.
Yeah, I think that's first really great to have somebody who's actually HIV positive on the floor helping to make decisions that will impact the lives of this immunocompromised community. It's not enough to just be an ally. You need somebody who's actually experienced, you know, what it's like to live with this. But in particular with Andrew, I love his like housing first kind of strategy when it comes to the unhoused community. Basically, like finding them housing, because once they are safe and secured and know that they have a roof over their heads, then you can deal with, you know, the social medical issues that have arisen. You can't deal with it until you know that, like, you're going to just have a safe place to rest your head. So I think that's something that he does that I think is really great. And I'm excited to see what happens, you know? The next candidate is also quite interesting, Rye Armstrong.
Yeah, Rye Armstrong, who wrote a couple weeks ago about Taproot Theater's gala for us very briefly. Rye uses all pronouns. They are mostly an actor and musician, and their campaign just made it onto the ballot. I got the press release for it. Rye says their campaign will focus on three goals: the right to shelter, making Seattle the first large carbon neutral city, and reforming Seattle police with independent accountability and robust resources for people of color and the SPD. So Rye was also on the show. We had a lovely conversation. I think they have pretty lofty goals. When it comes to practicality, it remains to be seen, but they openly admit that they don't have all the answers. And that's in that interview, and you can listen back to that. So, you know, good luck to them. Joy Hollingsworth, next up on the list. I really liked talking with Joy. We don't agree on most things, but she is goal-oriented. And I appreciate that in a politician. She has attainable goals. We don't endorse politicians here at the SGN. We're not like the Seattle Times. But Joy Hollingsworth, I think, is a really strong front runner. She has grown up in the community. She's grown up in Seattle specifically. And her whole family were activists and educators from her grandmother down. So I really like what Joy brings to the table, even if we disagree on, again, policing. But I think that her goals are possibly the most well laid out for any of the candidates that we've seen. And that's just great. You know, we have six more candidates to go over, but we do have to go to our ad break. And we'll get right back to this after my conversation with Isabel Sandoval. So all that and more after the break.
Hi, this is Dr. V. Hill with V. Hill Family Medicine. Ever wish your doctor knew you by name, understood where you were coming from, and listened to your unique health concerns and worries? I have built just such a practice where the focus is on you and the care delivered is in line with your values and ideals. Learn more about affirming primary care at VHIL Family Medicine. Visit VIGILMD.com or call 253-693-0071.
Looking for a career change? Plan to visit the 2023 Women in Trades Fair, a fun opportunity to learn about living wage and lucrative careers in the construction trades. You'll find every craft imaginable, from carpentry to welding, electrical line work to elevator construction, iron work to masonry, firefighting to meat cutting. It's all here, both indoors and outdoors. One day only on Friday, May 5th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Fisher Pavilion at Seattle Center. Free. All are welcome.
Presenting Translations, a film festival celebrating stories from the trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming community. From May 5th through the 8th, these virtual programs are available across the U.S. Attend our curated in-person screening May 7th at Northwest Film Forum in Seattle. Check out the schedule and buy passes at $3billcinema.org.
Joining me today via Zoom, she's a filmmaker and actor, one of the artist spotlights from the Translation Film Festival, and a Trailblazer Award recipient. She has a film called Lingua Franca and a short feature called Shangri-La. Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlethems, please give it up for Isabel Sandoval. Isabel, how are you today?
Hi, Ash. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. This is so exciting. I'm so honored and delighted to be receiving the Trailblazer Award from the Translations Film Festival this year.
Thank you so much for being here. Let's talk a little bit about you and your work. How did you get into film in the first place?
I actually do not have a conventional background in film. I did not go to film school. I was born and raised in the Philippines. But one of my earliest childhood memories was my mom taking me to a movie theater, starring the Filipino Charlie Chaplin. And I don't remember much about the movie. It was probably shit. I just remember being dazzled and enchanted by the gigantic images that were projected on the screen. And I think that started my fascination and my passion for cinema. You know, as I grew older, my taste in films became more discerning and sophisticated. So I graduated from kitschy, comedic, and horror Filipino films to art house and world cinema, you know, classics like the works of Kurosawa, Hitchcock, Almodovar, Wong Kar-wai. And then for undergrad, I went and studied psychology. So my very first job after college was actually in marketing. Okay. But then I, you know, decided to pursue a graduate degree. So I went to NYU, again, not to pursue film, but to study, you know, get my MBA degree. But the reason why I wanted to go to New York is because it's the capital of the independent film scene in the U.S. And so after I graduated from NYU, I decided to take the plunge and make my first short film, Senorita, which I then developed into my first full-length feature with the same title, Senorita. I have made 3 feature films since, the latest of which being Lingua Franca, which premiered at the 2019 Venice International Film Festival. And although it's my 3rd feature, it's my first after my gender transition, and it's my first to be set in and produced in the U.S.
There is sort of a magic and majesty to film, isn't there, that draws people in. Do you have a favorite genre you like working in?
Not necessarily a genre, but my sensibility tends to be for more, you know, lush, lyrical, sensuous type of films on the one hand, and also slightly, you know, darker, noirish, thrillerish types and TV projects on the other. I'm very, very thrilled that my first TV project as a director happened to be Under the Banner of Heaven, worlds away from Lingua Franca, Under the Banner of Heaven, which is based on the John Krakauer book about the murders that rocked the Mormon community in Salt Lake City back in the 80s. And it starred Andrew Garfield, Sam Worthington, and Daisy Edgar Jones, and was showrun and adapted by Academy Award winner Nelson Lance Black, who won the Oscar for Milk.
That's amazing. That's wonderful. Let's talk a little bit about the feature that's going to be at Translations this year, Lingua Franca. To ask, what's your movie about? It's one of those death sentences I feel for a conversation sometimes, but what's your movie about?
You know, set in New York City during the Trump administration, and it's, you know, not autobiographical. It's about an undocumented Filipino trans woman who works as a caregiver to a Russian Jewish woman who is suffering from dementia and finds herself in a tentative romantic relationship with the woman's adult grandson, who is not initially aware that the protagonist is trans. You know, I would call it a romantic drama that's tinged in anxiety and paranoia, because it's about this, you know, woman, Olivia, who is, you know, trying to go about her days and trying to get herself a green card at a time when there's very intense crackdowns on undocumented immigrant workers and facing the threat of deportation and arrests.
That Hitchcock influence coming in, multi-layered anxieties and social commentary. What do you hope that people get out of your film when they watch it?
Hopefully that, you know, they have a deeper understanding of the plights and experiences of both transgender women of color and also undocumented migrants in the U.S. And hopefully also, I mean, it's not your typical screechy and preachy social issue drama. It's a lot more quiet and subdued and subtle and nuanced. And yeah, I think it's really just showcasing a very different take on this type of material. A lot of my influences include Dilmun by the Belgian filmmaker Chantal Ackerman, which was recently voted the greatest film of all time in the recent Sight and Sound poll from last year, which I was invited to take part in vote in.
Do you feel that often social issues, especially when it comes to the queer community and the trans community especially, are not subtle? That there is a lack of artistry when approaching queer and especially trans issues in film and cinema?
I think, you know, just generally, especially if, you know, a work of art or a film or a TV show is made by someone who's not from the community, that there is a tendency to fixate on just the victimization and the misery and the trauma. Yeah. Instead of, I guess, the humanity and the complexity of our experience. And that's what I aim to do in Lingua Franca, to kind of avoid these very fetishistic takes and perspectives in terms of the suffering and the trauma. And, you know, in Lingua Franca, it very much acknowledges the circumstances, you know, and the predicament of the protagonist, but it doesn't wallow and dwell in it. There are moments of serenity and joy and, you know, fleeting glimpses of happiness, however fleeting and ephemeral they are.
So there are moments that are tragic, but because of the humanity of it, not because of the queerness of it.
Yeah. And, you know, because it is grounded in the reality of what it is to be an undocumented immigrant and a trans woman of color in the U.S., but it doesn't stop at being miserable. You know, it gives these characters a measure of hope, you know, and optimism, however cautious that optimism is.
Would you say that you yourself have a lot of hope as a person?
Yeah, and I'd like to think that I'm a humane and humanistic person. And this is, I think, evident in not just Lingua Franca, but my film before that. It's called Apparition, and it's about cloistered nuns in the Philippines during martial law in 1972. Yeah, and that I try to find the vulnerability and the cracks in the armor of characters that might, you know, seem villainous, you know, on the surface, but that they're being out most likely from a place of fear and insecurity. And I think that's what makes my film resonate on a more profound and complicated level, because it doesn't resort to easy judgment. Of course, there are people that do that, but I think for a love story or romantic drama like Lingua Franca, we need to bring out the depths and the layers of the humanity and the characters and their flaws for it to work.
Let's talk a little bit about the short film that you have at Translations, Shangri-La. I assume it's a very different plot line, very different type of story, but does it have the same themes?
It was actually commissioned by Prada, by Miu Miu, for their acclaimed short film series called Women's Tales, that have invited world-renowned female auteurs in the past, like Agnes Varda, Lucrecia Martel, more recently Ava DuVernay, Janixa Bravo. I was invited to make a short film for them. I was given carte blanche, essentially, to come up with a premise for the short film and incorporate very, you know, naturally some of their pieces, because Miu Miu is a fashion brand. And I came up with a story that is set during the Great Depression in the U.S. and, again, is a love story between a white farmer and this Filipina immigrant farmer. And it all takes place inside a confessional at a church where they're meeting secretly. And because during that time, during the Great Depression, there was an anti-miscegenation law which prohibits, you know, Filipinos, minority groups, from becoming romantically involved with whites at that time. But halfway through their conversation inside the confessional, we're taken on a kind of journey of this character's, this Philippine immigrant's, reveries and imagination and fantasy. So it becomes, you know, really about her subjectivity. And I would say that it takes my approach, my aesthetic approach in Lingua Franca, which is, it's a drama that's steeped in politics, but also has lyricism and poetry and sensuality to it. And I take that even further by highlighting the subjectivity and the inner emotional life of the protagonist.
Well, I've always found that there is poetry in the political. So do you feel that your work is going to be taking that direction, or has always taken that direction, been moving into the poetic political, as you put it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like when I started out, you know, art house Philippine cinema has been mostly known for a social realist type of aesthetic, and that it's, you know, it really focuses on the grinding poverty and the misery of the characters, like Filipino characters, especially in urban setting, you know, which is what a lot of Western film festival programmers typically, you know, want and look for from third world cinema.
Yeah.
But starting with Lingua Franca, I think it's also because having transitioned and becoming more comfortable in my own skin as a person, I've become more confident as an artist as well, that I wanted to strike out on my own and forge a path for me as an artist that would be ambitious and boldly different from what has come before. So I definitely am going in that direction, as you pointed out, especially with my upcoming feature called Tropical Gothic. It's a period drama that is set in the 16th century in the Philippines. And it's, you know, partly inspired by, I came up with the idea for it after watching Hitchcock's Vertigo for the very first time. But it's since evolved from that very, very early slash initial idea into, I think, something that's really risk-taking and audacious.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And you at home should come and see her film at the Translation Film Festival. It's going to be airing May 6th at the Arc Lodge Cinemas. The festival itself is going on from May 4th through 7th. Isabel, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything that you'd like to say to our listeners before we head out?
Thanks so much, Ash. Yeah, I'd like to invite everyone to come to the screenings at the Translations Film Festival. And I would also like to thank the festival and the organizers for honoring me with this inaugural Translations Trailblazer Award.
And where can we find you online?
I am on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is Isabel V. Sandoval on both platforms.
Wonderful. Well, again, thank you so much for being here. And yeah, take care.
Thanks, Ash.
And we're back. Thank you guys so much for sticking with us. We're going to continue to go over our coverage of D3 candidates, and then we can talk a little bit about some national news that's pretty important. Isabel, do you know anything about this next candidate for District 3, Asuka Jax?
I know nothing. I know nothing about this. But what I do know is that people always kind of forget about local politics. And they get all swept up in the big campaigns, the big re-elections, all the stuff that's happening on a national level. But I really think that where change actually happens is in the local communities. And it comes down to these races in order to make big changes across the country, because it's, you know, starts solidifying policies on a city basis. And then it opens up the room for leaders to kind of come out on a national level. So I'm wondering if any of these candidates could be someone to create real large-scale change. Do you know anything about Asuka?
I do know that we don't know their pronouns. I think they go by she, her, but I'm not certain. Asuka's run for a number of city offices, and they are mostly unfunded campaigns. And I do know that they have an association with Capitol Hill Pride, which is not Pride Fest and is not Seattle Pride. Capitol Hill Pride is, some listeners may remember, or readers may remember, the organization that we had to distance ourselves from back in 2021 because the head of it, Charlotte Lefevre, has had a number of issues throughout the years, but was specifically upset with taking Black Pride for a suggested donation of $5 for people who are not of color, calling it a, quote, reparations fee, more or less a tongue-in-cheek gesture, I believe. But, you know, if you're a white person going into taking Black Pride and trying to, you know, mingle, A, it's not for you, and B, pay $5. It's not much. God, I'm trying to be professional about this, but she got her ass handed to her by the Seattle Human Rights Commission back in 2021 for complaining about Black people as an angry white woman. Then she said that she banned police from Capitol Hill Pride, which was happening the same day as the opening of the AIDS Memorial Pathway. And, you know, then called the cops on somebody later on. But Asuka Jax is a sort of in that circle. I don't know anything else about her. I've seen her around, but I don't know anything about her policies or her beliefs or anything. I just know that she has an association with Charlotte Lefevre. Moving on to some new candidates, Alex Cooley. He says he was raised in an environment of physical, emotional, and substance abuse with his father. And then he was raised by his mom after 14 years.
The cool thing about him is he has a degree in education, but because of a hiring freeze, he turned his hobby of growing pot, marijuana, into a business. And so his goal is to legalize drugs and build 1 million square feet of housing for unhoused individuals. You know, I love a dream.
Yeah. I mean, he also grew up in a union house, so yeah. He has strong union ties. And he's worked to unionize workers at his retail store, which is called Solstice. He's not part of the LGBTQ community, but neither are the next few candidates. We've got Robert Goodwin, who describes himself as the only candidate for District 3 that is committed to prioritizing cleaning up this city.
And he means physically. He wants to eliminate graffiti in District 3. I just don't think that that is the most important thing right now. I also think that graffiti is a great way for, like, communities to speak up and to share their art and to, like, be self-expressive.
He sounds like a landlord. He's campaigning against short-term rentals and ticket scalping. This seems like a very financially driven person. Yeah. I don't think that he necessarily has his finger on the pulse of, definitely not Capitol Hill, but District 3 as a whole. He sounds like one of my neighbors here in Eastlake, if I'm being completely honest. But that is District 3, so we'll see how that goes.
The other candidate, Efrain Hudnell, how do you?
Efrain Hudnell, I think, is correct. Maybe if we've got him on the show, he can correct us.
Yeah.
But he's a former U.S. Army intelligence officer, current deputy prosecutor in King County's mental health court.
Awesome.
He wants to become a prosecutor in general. He wanted to use the law as a tool to fix systemic problems rather than to maintain outcomes of unjust system. He's not a member of the LGBTQ plus community, but he does stress the need for non-criminal intervention and for greatly expanding behavioral health services.
Speak in my love language. I love that.
Alex Hudson, we've talked about before. I do want to have her on the show as well. She is an urbanist, first and foremost. I know that she's worked with some of my friends who work in the city. They are a part of SDOT and the Department of Transit. She comes highly recommended, actually, from the people that have worked with her. So that is a huge, huge thing. She believes the city needs to find alternatives for uniformed police,
yes,
drug counselors, housing connectors, and things of that nature. And she was a blogger for Seattleish, and we love a writer here at the SGN, right? So that's something interesting to look into. We're just running through these as quickly as possible because we got more stuff to cover.
The last one, Theo Mostert, the medical technician.
Okay, so here's what he says. Seattle is in trouble, and our current leadership is digging us even deeper in the hole.
Okay.
And honestly, yeah.
It's not wrong.
I mean, he's not wrong. It does seem like he's kind of running on a doom and gloom campaign just on that statement alone.
It's a little vague.
Improving public safety and improving first responder training and working conditions.
That's great. It's all very vague.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like houselessness is a main thing here, helping the unhoused moving forward. We have a couple of candidates that have green policies, and that's great. We're still, of course, pulling for the queer candidates because Capitol Hill is one of the biggest neighborhoods in the district and the city. And it would be great to have more LGBTQ representation in local government in general. More on that as it develops going forward. And hopefully we can get some of these folks on the show, an open call. I'm going to be emailing all of you if you haven't been on the show. And if you have, maybe we can have you back on again to see how it's developing for you. Love to hear from all of our local politicians because that's where the magic happens, as Isabel was saying earlier.
And if you're not registered to vote, make sure you do that now.
Yeah, it's 2023. You should be voting.
It's time. You should be voting. Voting day is on November 7th. So make sure that you register, get everything that you need, and make a voting plan. All of the things that we're talking about, they only matter if you actually show up. So please do so.
And show up for the primaries as well, August 1st, 2023. Moving along, yeah, still talking politics, but on a national scale, Zoe Zephyr, who's the first openly trans member of Montana's legislature, was silenced by Montana Republicans for breaking decorum. Look, here's a non-professional and unprofessional opinion. Fucking badass, dude.
Such a badass.
She's rad, but on another very deeply terrifying level, the supermajority of Republicans silenced her, banned her from the anteroom, the House floor, the gallery, because of her comments on Senate Bill 99, which would ban transgender health care treatments for minors in the state. Here's the quote from Zephyr, because this is why she was voted against in silence. She said, "If you vote yes on this bill and yes on these amendments, I hope the next time there's an invocation when you bow your heads in prayer, you see the blood on your hands."
Holy shit.
Very powerful words. My first reaction was, wow, that's metal as fuck, but that's not why we're here to talk about it.
So metal.
It's also accurate. I would say, as a gender diverse person, that this bill is tragically against my needs, and it's part of that anti-trans legislation that is getting pushed right now across the country.
There's a motion that says that Zoe would be allowed to speak in the chamber again only if she apologized for her comments.
Which is petty.
It's such bullshit. It's so petty. And in response, she said, "When the speaker asks me to apologize on behalf of decorum, what he is really asking me to do is be silent when my community is facing bills that get us killed. He is asking me to be complicit in the legislature's eradication of our community, and I refuse to do so." Mic drop.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's been protests outside of the State House by Zephyr's supporters. She's been a very vocal advocate for trans rights. She's a trans woman and a trans activist. And we'll see how that shakes out. But until then, she is not allowed to do her job effectively. She can still vote remotely, but she's not allowed in the State House until May 10th, essentially.
Oh, it just lights a fire. It makes me so angry.
Yeah, it's upsetting. A little hometown news for me. More national news. San Francisco is repealing their boycott of anti-LGBTQ plus states. So back in 2016, a little bit of context, San Francisco was like, hey, we're not going to pay for our government officials to travel to anti-queer states, basically. And that eventually got expanded to include anti-abortion rights states and restriction on voting rights. And the hope there, I believe, was that a bunch of cities, especially on the West Coast and East Coast, would do that, and it would put financial pressure on red states to change their minds. Unfortunately,
that didn't happen.
It didn't happen at all. They didn't see the support they were expecting. It was kind of a huge leap. California recently has also put into effect a state wide travel ban for government officials to 23 states with anti-LGBTQ plus legislation, but they are currently reconsidering. I remember I was a barista working when this bill got passed, and I was like, that's stupid. I know what they're going for, but this is, in my opinion, why a lot of people think that the West Coast is elitist and out of touch. This is one of those policies that hurts itself more than it does any good. We don't meet in the middle a lot of times, and I'm not a centrist by any means, but this is one of those things that it seems like they had lofty goals and no follow through.
And it ended up hurting them in the long run.
Yeah, it definitely did. It ended up costing them a lot of money, and it ended up not affecting these other states at all. I honestly forgot that this ban was in place until they repealed it, because it had no effect. And that's a shame, and it's something that I think Gavin Newsom and the state of California in general is going to be reconsidering in the very near future.
Which would be really interesting to see how it actually works, because I don't think it's enough to just ban government officials from traveling to those states. I think that it needs to be bigger than that. I'm talking like, let's cut trade, man. Let's just say fuck you to all those states and just, I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, so that's actually a thought that does get passed around back home a lot. The secessionist movement is alive. It's not very strong.
Yeah.
But a lot of Californians, when I was back there, like especially 2016, were talking about seceding. You know, there's an idea that since California has the fifth or sixth highest GDP in the world,
they could do it.
They could do it if they wanted to. The problem is that they're also kind of eating each other alive because the North and South don't agree. The liberals and conservatives don't agree. The leftists and far right don't agree. Yeah, California's supposed to be this like big liberal thing. Things are a little different back home, but it's also like the home of Adam Waffen. It's not practical right now, but also this debate has been going on for, I feel like, a decade now of people saying, hey, we could be six states and we could all have our own voice. It's very practical mindset to believe that the conservative pockets in the North, especially Jefferson, which is like an unofficial 51st state right between the south of Oregon and the north of California, like if they really wanted to, they could get rid of the water supply going to Southern California and cause that whole area, which is already affected by drought, to cease to have any agricultural value. So we'd have to kind of work on ourselves first as Californians before seceding. It's kind of why I like the idea of Cascadia, even though I didn't even hear about it until moving up here. But it's about practicality and it's about military strength. And I don't think that a lot of the people that believe in secession also believe in violence, which, you know, is kind of goofy.
Super goofy. Great idea in theory, but not something that will actually work.
Yeah, I mean, just to be me here for a second, I guess the United States is kind of crumbling under its own weight as we speak, so maybe we wouldn't even have to do anything.
I don't know. I think there's another solution, and I truly believe that it is the full legalization of psychedelics for recreational use. I think that, you know, mushrooms, LSD, all of the drugs that allow you to connect deeper with the earth and the world as a whole is what will solve humanity's crisis.
I think without adding philosophy to basic education again, without enforcing our educators and reinforcing our school systems, no matter how much introspection and psychedelics we do, we're not going to have any guidance. What we are going to have are thought leaders like Jordan Peterson, you know, who take over and get in there with these ideas of basically victimization of the upper echelon and the least oppressed. And that's upsetting to think about, right? So I think that a large portion of the problems that we face today, it's not just a lack of introspection or a lack of giving ourselves the space to think, which is what psychedelics often do, right? I think we don't think about it while we're working. We're worked very hard and we're struggling to survive on a financial level, but we are also not given the tools to think critically by and large in our educational system.
It all comes down to our teachers. It comes to hiring teachers, paying them more, making sure that there is diversity can solve so many problems.
Well, and also making sure that if we are going to have standardized tests, that we also have some sort of tool set for critical thinking and philosophizing.
Across all states.
Across all states, yeah.
You have one state teaching a totally different curriculum that just creates this even larger divide. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done within, I think, pretty much every system that the U.S. has in place right now.
Yeah, and on a smaller scale, you know, we can just take the time to learn ourselves, right?
Absolutely.
But when we don't do that, we get sort of blindsided by these so-called thought leaders like Andrew Tate or whatever that get a lot of press, even on my page, which is scary to think about. But yeah, we just kind of get fed these ideas that we are not familiar with and don't have the capacity often to critically think about.
We should definitely add some positivity to this. This is a heavy episode.
I guess. I feel like we've been pretty upbeat so far. But we could talk about Can-Can for a brief second. Can-Can, of course, a wonderful theater here in Seattle, a cabaret that I have a deep fondness for in my heart. Their shows are always really great. Lindsay Anderson, she went and saw their show Noir, which she called Pure Vibes.
It looks amazing. I think it's playing until June 25th. You can get tickets at tickets.thecancan.com. And Lindsay also recommends that when you go, you have to have an order of beignets.
The croissant beignets are especially good, yeah.
And there's like a berry and a caramel sauce that just like sounds like a vibe. She's totally right. It is a vibe.
I've never been to a bad Can-Can show. And I think everyone that works there is really stellar and very kind. It's definitely a vibe, I guess, is the best way to put it. It's wonderful.
There's also 10% off tickets for Mother's Day on May 14th. So grab your mom or somebody who you want to be your mom and take them to a show.
Absolutely. Well, Isabel, that's our time. Is there anything you want to say to folks before we head out?
Yes. One thing that I've been going through that I've been experiencing is I came out as bi when I was 22. And then pretty soon after, I immediately met my husband and I fell in love hard. And I was expecting to go off on this like exploration, this journey, and instead I fell in love. And what I'm learning now is that queerness and sexuality is a journey that goes on forever. And there are so many different ways that you can explore it, but a lot of it is looking inward and challenging some of the ideals or expectations or pressure that society puts on you to look a certain way. I've been feeling really frustrated about not feeling like I fit in anywhere as a bisexual woman who's in a straight passing relationship. And especially as pride comes up, I have started to feel like I need to get involved more to do more. But that also comes with the thoughts in the back of my mind of like, is this your time to take up space? And if I say no, then I am telling that, you know, 15-year-old version of myself that she doesn't deserve to take up space. And I don't know, this is all just to say that wherever you are on your journey of sexuality and queerness, we're right there with you. I'm right there with you. And I'm here if you guys need anything and to submit your questions to Ask Izzy. And I want to talk about this, the messiness of queerness. I think it's really important.
Absolutely. You can go to sgn.org and click on the Ask Izzy tab. We are still working on getting all of those Ask Izzys in one place, but it's a little bit of a struggle on the back end for our programmers. We're figuring it out, though. Well, folks, if you like us, go ahead and give us that 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you hate us, go ahead and send us to someone who you think will like us. And if you could go to sgn.org and click on that pink donate button, we need that cash. We are working on moving in a very interesting and fun and beautiful direction in the near future.
But we need your help.
We do need your help. And we do have advertisers, but our strength and our finances really do come from listeners and readers. Just like you. Guys, that's our show. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the funny pages.
Bye, guys. See you later.
Radio SGN is hosted by A.V. Eichenbaum and Lindsay Anderson, and produced by A.V. Eichenbaum. Music for this show was provided by T.R.G. Banks and Jesse Spillane, or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org or wherever you find podcasts. This podcast is part of the Seattle Gay News Podcasting Network.